Hello, and welcome to the Hypnosis and NLP podcast, the podcast that teaches you how to tap into the power of your subconscious mind to improve your life. My name is Donald Curry. I'm a registered psychotherapist, master hypnotherapist, NLP practitioner, and hypnosis instructor. In today's episode, we have Ian Mukherjee with us, who is known as the working man's therapist. He specializes in anxiety, low self-esteem, men's issues, childhood trauma, PTSD, hypnotherapy, and EMDR therapy. Ian is here today to discuss with us the work that he does, as well as mental health challenges that are impacting men. So, Ian, thank you so much for being with us today. And taking this time to come in and talk a little bit about men's mental health, what you do. So why don't you take a few moments and tell us why you decided to become a therapist? Mm-hmm.
Thanks so much for having me here, Donald. It's like a big privilege to be here.
Well, thank you for being here.
Thank you. Yeah. So what got me into therapy was basically my corporate experience. So at the age of 26, I became the data analyst for our COO of commercial banking's personal sort of data guy kind of a thing.
Right.
And initially that was a great accomplishment for me. I was like, oh, look at me. I'm going to do my MBA and climb the ladder and whatnot. But very soon I saw really nasty C-suite culture, right? And you may, appreciate with this given your own corporate background.
Yeah, I was in investment banking as well. Mm-hmm. And the culture was extremely toxic. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of backstabbing that mm-hmm. was going on. Mm-hmm. A lot of aggression. Mm-hmm. I noticed a lot of aggression when mm-hmm. I was working at the bank. Mm-hmm. Investment banking at that time was, we're talking 20 years ago mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. It was predominantly male.
Yeah.
Male industry. And mm-hmm. Unfortunately, there was a lot of aggression that mm-hmm. I experienced.
Yeah, for sure.
And I made the decision, this isn't where I want to be.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, and similarly, so given that nasty culture that I saw, it gave me a bit of an existential crisis and a bit of a depression in 2012. That is this what I want to do? Is this where I want to go? This is the top, and this is how the top, if this is how the top looks, this is what I want to do. And I also had a bit of a spiritual awakening in 2012, and I, with all of that, I got into therapy in 2013. And given that my mom's a psychotherapist back in India, and I just really liked the process. I was like, I like this, and I thought that people, friends of mine, have opened up to me in the past, and I haven't looked at it as some people are like, oh, don't tell me this. Why are you telling me this? Yeah. Go tell it to someone else.
Yeah.
But I never felt that. I was like, oh, sure. Tell,
I only want to see the good parts of you.
Yeah.
Right.
But I was like, okay, yeah, sure. Tell me. And, that sort of that along with the therapy process, then I, joined the, part-time diploma program at Transformational Arts College in 2013. And, that's how I got into it.
Okay. And, you mentioned that you were in therapy, mm-hmm. right? And I know taking a psychotherapy program, mm-hmm. there's a certain amount of hours. I believe it's like 100 hours of psychotherapy. So what personal gains did you mm-hmm. see mm-hmm. as a result of engaging in therapy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. Initially, one of the biggest gains that I had was in my own attachment patterns, So I was having, the relationships that I was getting into and things like that. And I credit therapy for meeting my wife and, for the marriage that we have right now. And I believe I wouldn't have had that if I didn't go through that process. And secondly, the other big gain was changing my belief structures around poverty consciousness, around, doing the 9-to-5 job. I mean, think about it this way, that for an Indian guy, where I grew up in this thing that you got to do your job, you got to, climb the ladder. This from moving from there to, becoming a psychotherapist in private practice. I mean, it required a big change in beliefs, and I credit that to therapy.
Great. Yeah, and I can definitely attest to that as well. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of the belief around the 9-to-5 job, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And this is how things have to be in yeah. order to make a living,
yeah.
which is absolutely nonsense,
yeah.
right?
Right?
Yeah, and the other belief that I work through is you have to work hard mm-hmm. to make money,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And that is so not true. It's yeah. about working intelligently,
yeah.
right? Exactly. I know so many people that work hard and they are barely making ends meet,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So I love challenging those belief mm-hmm. systems,
exactly.
right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Sort of those, you know, doing that work as system breaking, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Breaking all those systems yeah. and dismantling them.
Yeah.
So you refer to yourself as the working man's therapist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about what that means and,
yeah,
and where
sure.
that idea came from?
Sure. So when I was doing my case studies, what I noticed was that 70 to 80% of my clientele were men.
And that's extremely high.
Yeah, that's really
therapy,
high for
right?
therapy. It's,
yeah.
Otherwise, it's a pretty female-dominated world.
Yes.
And so it's quite high in that sense. And I didn't really do any special marketing to get that. It just organically happened.
Yes.
I just attracted that crowd. And so last summer, I decided that, okay, I want to, you know, sort of brand myself in a way. And so that's where Working Man's Therapist Toronto came up. And right. I was like, oh, that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
And
it's a great idea.
Yeah. yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
And the ethos behind that title is that I want to be, given my experience as average Joe working in corporate Toronto,
right?
I want to be this person who's relatable, approachable, and sort of like the guy sitting next to you in the cubicle, you know,
right.
who you can actually connect with and share with, rather than this sort of advice giving sort
yeah.
of doctor, psychologist, you know, that sort yeah. of
top down
approach.
Yeah, more mutual approach.
Yeah, more mutual and collaborative.
Sense. Yeah. And, you know, there's this message, especially in North America, I know, I'm sure in other parts of mm-hmm. the world as well, mm-hmm. where, you know, emotional expression mm-hmm. in men when we're young, and mm-hmm. I experience this mm-hmm. and I'm, you know, is, you know, men should not have emotion, right? Mm-hmm. That, you know, pull up your bootstraps, mm-hmm. Man up,
yeah.
don't cry, man. Or I'll give you something to cry about.
Yeah.
That emotional suppression,
mm-hmm.
you know, oftentimes leads to problems and symptomatology
oh, sure. yeah.
down the road.
Mm-hmm.
So what's your experience with that? And, you know, as a result of maybe some of the messaging
yeah.
that,
yeah.
that, people receive when they're children, men specifically,
sure.
what the effects of that is.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of the clients that I'm seeing actually right now, a lot of them have domestic violence history. So,
okay.
you know, sort yeah. of physically, verbally abused by dad or like stepdads or older brothers, or they have like missing male role models. So dad left.
Right.
At age 5 and, you know, things like that, single mom raising boys.
Yeah.
And so they have that deficit in a way.
Yeah.
And so they learn about, you know, how to be a man from rap culture or from
right.
like, you
yeah.
know, gangster culture or like all kinds of, you know, places where it's not the most healthiest definition of what's it like to be a man.
Right.
And that's when you see a lot of that emotional suppression. And I see that it's two archetypes. One is the tough guy, bad boy archetype, which
is very prevalent.
Yeah, very right. prevalent. And there you have the person sort of disowning and dissociating from their sadness and the sad little boy, sad inner child. And on the other side, which is a more of a Canadian thing, the nice guy archetype,
right.
you know.
Step on someone's foot in the subway and then they say, I'm
yeah.
sorry, right?
Exactly. So basically taking care of everyone else's needs and, you know, just becoming a bit of a doormat.
Yeah.
And they are dissociated from their anger because they were right. told as children that, oh, no one wants to play with an angry boy.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And yeah. So those are the two main things that I see.
And be a good boy.
Be a good boy.
Be
yeah.
a good boy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Don't get angry.
Yeah.
Yeah. You just mentioned dissociation,
mm-hmm.
right? Can you tell us a little bit about dissociation in mm-hmm. male mental health mm-hmm. and maybe a little bit about what dissociation is and sure. how that is affecting men.
Sure. So dissociation is one of our, you know, primal defense mechanisms and one of the things that the body does unconsciously. Just like similar to fight, flight, freeze, submit, dissociation is one of those. So for example, you may have seen that, you know, some or heard that, you know, someone has an accident, has a car accident, and here they are all bleeding and kind of mangled. Mm-hmm. And yet they're able to, like, you know, nonchalantly, you know, walk a mile, go somewhere, do something, right. call 911, yeah. help someone else.
There's been the cases of people actually lifting up cars yeah. off of yeah. another person.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
And this is where this is the brain's way of making sure that they're able to get things done
yes.
without, you know, succumbing to the pain and the shock. And this is where dissociation comes in, as they right. dissociate away from the pain and the shock, and they're able to keep their mental faculties switched on.
Right.
Right. So dissociation in that sense can be quite helpful. If you're trying to focus on something, if you're trying to study something and you want to drown out what's happening around you, that's a form of dissociation.
Right.
You know, it's also similar to highway hypnosis, as we
yes.
tell our hypnosis clients.
Right? Driving down the highway, the mind's drifting and wandering, but exactly. the car is driving itself. The car is
driving itself. Yeah. And if someone yeah. cuts you, you will break. You will break maybe faster than when you're actually consciously paying attention to the road.
Right.
Because your body is very tuned in to the road in a different way. So dissociation is good, but it becomes a problem when it's not being utilized in appropriate ways. When it's right. actually being utilized in a way to protect you from certain feelings and emotions.
Yes.
Protection that you needed maybe when you were 5 years old, but at the age of 35, you no longer need that protection, but this is what the brain learned to do, and this is right. what the brain's doing.
Especially when there's an emotion yeah. that's there that's really overwhelming.
Yeah.
And someone doesn't know mm-hmm. how to deal with it.
Yeah.
Right? Exactly. It's so uncomfortable. Dissociation is a wonderful tool
yeah.
to help people be able to cope mm-hmm. with that emotion without exactly. having to go into it, right?
Exactly.
And sometimes people, you know, as a means of dissociating further from mm-hmm. pain will mm-hmm. oftentimes pick an addiction,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Whether that's alcohol or drugs yeah. or work or
yeah.
video games, right?
Yeah. yeah. Because, yeah, addictions are primarily that, right? They're like an escape route.
That's
yeah,
right.
yeah. They are a chemical or a process, either chemicals or a process which helps you to check out.
Right.
In a way.
Yeah.
Right? Check out from what's happening within you right now.
And it's a very intelligent, mm-hmm. adaptive strategy
yeah, exactly.
in dealing with overwhelming yeah, emotions.
Yeah. And yeah. when I see clients who come to me with, say, alcohol or, you know, narcotic addiction, I tell them that, you know, instead of looking at it as, oh my God, terrible you, how yeah. bad, you know, shitty. It's not.
It's not.
It's a yeah. way that it's actually it's ingenious adaptation to take you away from.
That's exactly what I said to my client as yeah. well. I'm like, your system is so wise
yeah.
that it came up with this way
exactly.
of managing
exactly.
the emotions. So that's actually a very yeah. intelligent
yeah. Yeah, exactly.
way of dealing with it.
Exactly.
So I agree with you on that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And where this work leads to is that this idea of internal family systems or structural dissociation.
Yeah.
These are two modalities which use this concept of dissociation.
Yes.
And we are looking at ourselves, instead of a monolithic identity, monolithic sense of self, we're looking at ourselves as multiple, you know, not multiple personality disorder, but like multiplicity of the self.
Yeah, and it's almost, the way that I describe it is, you know, mm-hmm. it's almost like a diamond. Or mm-hmm. a jewel that has all nice. Of these different sides to it.
And you facets.
Turn it, yeah, facets, right? Mm-hmm. And you turn it this way and you can see one side and mm-hmm. you turn it this way and you can mm-hmm. see another side.
Yeah.
And it's all mm-hmm. it's the way that the light mm-hmm. is hitting
yeah.
that, and the light being the consciousness,
yeah.
right? It's the way that the light is hitting that,
yeah.
that diamond. We have
exactly.
It's the way that our consciousness is hitting all these different
exactly.
facets
yeah.
of ourselves
yeah.
and bringing
yeah.
them out.
And the easiest way I would say to also understand this is, you know, when you are actually having a dilemma, right?
Yes.
A part of you wants to do this. Part of you, you know, needs to go to work, get up.
Yeah.
If you're doing the 9 to 5,
yeah.
you need to get up and go to your job by 9 a.m. But a part of you wants to sleep in. Part of you is not interested.
Inner conflict.
Inner conflict, yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And one of the things, the whole thing with parts work is to reduce the amount of inner conflict
that we're having. Yeah. And really harmonize and align those parts of systems so that they're more integrated together and working together as opposed to opposite one another, right?
Yeah.
Amazing. That's really great. So when you look at this idea of conscious masculine, right, or conscious male, in the yoga environment or the spiritual communities or the therapy communities, that term is being used quite readily these days. So can you give us an your idea on this concept of conscious masculine and what that means?
Sure. I mean, during my own sort of spiritual awakening in 2012, 2013, I got quite a bit into the sort of the new age yoga community. And the conscious man there is hot commodity, right? It's right. Like everyone wants to be a conscious man or be with a conscious man. So, but what I noticed was that, you know, it was sort of the conscious male thing was getting kind of diluted with a lot of consumerism. There was this whole thing that, oh, you need to be this, you know, matcha tea, shaga mushroom, ingesting, yoga doing, hippie.
So in order to be conscious masculine, there were stipulations.
Yeah, it was stipulation. Yeah. That you got to be living this lifestyle, otherwise you're not conscious.
Right.
But in my opinion, you know, you can be this guy working at RBC, be a senior manager at RBC and yet be super conscious.
Right.
You know, and the way we become conscious is to bring light to the dark corners of our mind, right? And
right.
That's consciousness basically. And where we are, where you are actually questioning the beliefs that have been given to you by society, by your family, by your culture. And just noticing which beliefs work for you, which and which don't, and then the ones that don't, you're actively working to change them.
And that's a really a humanistic approach that anyone can apply, male or female, to themselves and to their life. It's all about, like you said, shining the light on those dark corners of our ourselves, our shadow side, really being aware of that and working to enlighten ourselves.
Exactly. Right?
Wonderful. So you use hypnosis in your practice. Can you describe how you use hypnosis and the results that you've seen?
Sure. I actually use hypnosis in three ways. The first way is using it as a tool to help my clients improve their emotional affect management.
Okay.
So, you know, teaching them self-hypnosis, teaching them, you know, sort of breathing, progressive relaxation techniques so that they can take care of themselves and, you know, it acts like stress reduction technique in a way. The second way is where I'm using it to deepen, you know, regular talk therapy. So when a client says, I want to talk about something, something, I'm like, okay, either you can just talk about it in a superficial manner, like you're just telling me a story, or we can, you know, bring in a mild amount of hypnotic trance, and then you tell me this thing with the emotions, with a lot more richness.
Right. You
know? And and it things go deeper.
Yes.
And the third way is where I'm using it in conjunction with some of the other modalities that I practice, such as EMDR, brain spotting, where I'm using hypnosis to, you know, do regressions, for example, like, you know, doing inner child work, going into memories. In a safe manner.
Because when we experience trauma, just to kind of expand on this for the listeners, when we experience trauma, that gets locked in the nervous system, right? And there is that part of us that is continuing to experience that trauma, and it is that part that sort of gets frozen in time. Right.
Exactly.
So even though there's parts of us that know that we're not there anymore, there are parts of us that still believe that we are in that trauma and that the world is not safe.
Exactly. And the parts that do believe are in our subconscious.
That's right. And it's very difficult to access them.
Yeah.
conscious life.
So without hypnosis and without certain trauma techniques, it's actually very hard to act. So I'm sure you have seen clients as well who have done like 5 years of regular talk therapy and nothing has changed.
Yeah, that's actually, you know, that's very common, right? People do a lot of talk therapy, but it's not viewed, that therapy is not viewed through the lens of trauma, right? And working with a trauma-informed therapist is very different because they add that lens over top as to, you know, viewing all of that past trauma and the impact that that is still having today.
Yeah.
And once you start using, there's a technique that's called time orientation, right? Which is all a wonderful technique of assisting all of these subconscious parts and helping them to recognize that they're no longer in that trauma, that they're living in the present.
Yeah.
I find just doing time orientation is huge in a lot of the trauma response and the fight or flight response starts to dissolve and go away.
Yeah. I mean, you can see clients calming, you know, relaxing in session itself as their parts get, you know, time oriented into present time. You know,
that's like
you can see the body itself sort of melting into the chair a little bit.
Yeah. And they start to feel safe in their own skin, I find too, right? You know, when they start to when all parts of them start to recognize that they're not there anymore, right?
Exactly.
It can be a very wonderful thing. And also, you know, recognizing the resources that people have. Because when we're 8 years old, we don't always have resources available to us that we do as an adult.
Yeah.
So a part of the process of working with trauma as well is also helping people to recognize those resources that they have as an adult, right?
Yeah.
And beginning to recognize that they can protect themselves
exactly
in a way now at 35 that they couldn't when they were five.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So it's very, very powerful
work.
Now you have an Instagram account and I actually am a subscriber. What's your Instagram username?
So my username is my first name. So Ayan underscore Mukherjee. Kind of hard to remember, but.
And how do you spell that?
Mukherjee.
Okay.
And then an underscore after that.
Underscore after that. And I'll put it in the link below, but you do some wonderful cartoons on mental health issues and therapy. And as a therapist, I find them very entertaining, right? So what gave you the, and also from a personal perspective, I find them, you know, great reminders.
Yeah.
So what gave you the inspiration to come up with this concept?
Sure. So I used to draw a lot when I was a kid, and up until like 15, 16 years of age, I used to like doodle quite a bit in my notebooks and things like that. And as so often it happens, I grew up after that and I stopped drawing. I was disconnected from this hobby of mine. Until very recently, my wife had been pestering me to join Instagram. And I used to be like, I don't take pictures. What will I do on Instagram? And then in June, I opened my account and I saw a lot of these mental health artists and, you know, people who do doodles. And I was like, oh, I can try doing some of that. And so now I just use it as a way for my own self-care, creative self-care, as well as, you know, spreading mental health awareness. And also using it as a marketing tool. And I want to mention this to the other therapists and practitioners in your audience that, you know, marketing doesn't have to be a scary monster, that it could be something that's fun and creative. You know? And I believe that you have your YouTube channel.
I do. And I find it's sort of threefold for me. You know, number one, it's good for marketing, getting people aware of what I do. It's good for my creativity, right? And and it's very good in that respect. Mm-hmm. And it's good to get that information out there,
exactly,
as well, right?
Yeah.
So, these social media can be a wonderful tool when you use it, right?
For sure.
A lot of people are sort of afraid of starting therapy. I can look back to my past and I can think of those times where I would tell myself, yeah, I'm fine. I don't need therapy. Everything's okay. What would you say to people who are maybe afraid of starting therapy?
Mm-hmm. For sure. One of the things that I offer is a free 30-minute phone consultation initially. And that's where I actually talk to a lot of these men were coming in with a lot of skepticism, reluctance, fear, because they don't understand the process, and also because therapy has been the way therapy has been portrayed in mainstream culture, as, you know, you're supposed to basically talk about your feelings while this guy sits there, kind of judges you a little bit, and draws doodles in his notebook.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So which is way, so not true.
Yeah, right? Very passive and kind of...
So not true.
So what I tell them is that it doesn't have to be like that. Mm-hmm. Therapy is not... It's not just about talking about your feelings, okay? Yeah. And with men, I believe if they have been socialized to not talk about their feelings, it can be quite challenging to do that in therapy.
Yeah, it can be.
Yeah, and instead I work with them to look at, you know, say body sensations, for example, or look at, you know, thought patterns rather than, you know, identifying and labeling feelings right away.
Yeah.
And doing so in a way that's collaborative. So with men, I've seen that once you're able to get their buy-in, once you're able to show them how this process can really help them and get their buy-in, they can make some of the best clients. Like they are really, you know, they can be very conscientious, very hardworking in therapy. Yeah. As long as you're able to show them how this can help them.
That's right. And I think too, it's meeting them where they are.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Because oftentimes if you're meeting someone and you know, with their feelings and they're not ready to do that yet, then they're going to shut down. They're going to go away and they're going to say, yeah, I don't want to do therapy. Right. Yeah. So it is so important to meet them where they are.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe it is working with body sensations or thoughts, as you said, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wonderful. Yeah, just adapting to them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you also use EMDR in your practice.
Mm-hmm.
And recently you also said that you've been adding brain spotting.
Mm-hmm.
And so can you tell us a little bit about how you use EMDR?
Sure.
And also how you're using brain spotting as well. Sure. I'm interested in that myself.
Nice. So EMDR for your audience, that's eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. It's a therapeutic modality that, according to American Psychological Association, is one of the, you know, the tried and tested and one of the best modalities for trauma and PTSD.
Most effective.
Most effective
for PTSD.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a way of basically reprocessing old traumatic memories, you know?
Right.
So what you're basically trying to do is, if you take two memories, one of being bullied at age 13 versus what you had for breakfast yesterday, both are memories, but one has a lot of emotional charge and the other is like just meh.
Yeah.
Right? You're basically trying to convert that emotionally charged memory into something similar to what you had for breakfast yesterday.
So that there's zero emotional charge around that memory.
Exactly.
Right.
And that's sort of the whole EMDR model in a nutshell. And I use it in a trauma-informed, what we call a triphasic trauma-informed way.
Yes.
To unpack that. Triphasic means we are looking at it in three phases. So the first phase is that of stabilization. So when a person comes in with significant trauma history, we first make sure that the client is stable enough to deal with difficult emotions, right?
That's right.
We bring in, you know, stress reduction, mindfulness, self-hypnosis, all that kind of stuff, and parts work in the initial phase.
Yeah.
The second phase then becomes where we actually get into the meat and potatoes of EMDR and brain spotting, where we do the reprocessing of the memories. And the third phase is integration. So once the memories have been reprocessed, how are you, grounding these gains into your everyday life?
Right. And when there's trauma, we develop maladaptive belief systems or maladaptive information, right?
Yeah.
So say, for example, someone had a trauma where they were up in front of their class, they were giving a speech and they forgot what they were saying. Mm-hmm. They may develop this maladaptive belief system around, I'm stupid, I'm not good enough, I'm not smart enough, I can't do anything right.
Yeah.
And what the goal, just for example, with EMDR is to take that memory, for example, and to reprocess that information pertaining to that belief system and the emotional charge around that, and eventually moving it so that that person is to develop a more adaptive belief system, right? Yeah. such as, you know, I'm smart, I'm fine,
yeah.
I'm allowed to make mistakes,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
and even looking at it with humor, right?
Yeah, nice.
So that is really what the gist of EMDR as well is.
Yeah. And to add to that, brain spotting, it actually originated from EMDR. It's like an offshoot of EMDR.
Which is an offshoot of hypnosis EMDR, right?
So, and brain spotting, just quickly, it's basically, if you've noticed that when you're actually trying to think of something, you may often look at a point. You know, you might be looking at the ceiling, looking at the floor.
Eye accessing cues, is that what they refer to them as?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's the same as NLP.
Similar, to,
yeah.
Similar
because to in NLP, we use what are known as eye accessing cues. So looking at the ground is remembering a feeling.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. If you look to the right, it's remembering an auditory cue or a voice.
Yeah.
And looking up is visual. I'm not sure what it is.
So I think in brain spotting that the visual field is apparently a lot more intuitive. So the whole idea being that when the person is in the trauma memory, this is very similar to the EMDR process. You basically get them into the trauma memory network.
Okay.
And then you ask them to basically, you put a pointer in front of them and ask them to basically look at wherever they want to look at.
Right.
It's the, and it's basically the visual point which intuitively aligns with that trauma memory.
Okay.
And then you can give something like audio bilateral stimulation. So like just, you know,
so sort of ocean similar tracks to EMDR, or something. Yeah,
very similar. Yeah. But instead of doing the eye movements stop and start, which is something, you know, where you're starting the bilateral stimulation, then stopping. Here you just ask them to gaze at that point.
Right.
And so it can be a lot more smoother where the client actually modulates and titrates their experience rather than you as therapist starting and stopping.
Okay, excellent. Great. Well, Ian, thank you so much for sharing all of this information with us today. You have a personal website. Mm-hmm. So can you tell us what is your website?
Sure. Thanks for having me. This was great. And my website is www.aynrp.com.
And you do offer sessions online over Skype or
I do
the internet.
Yeah, okay. I do offer video conferencing sessions. And I also offer a free 30-minute phone consult. No commitment, no charge.
Excellent.
Just to look at fit.
Thank you so much for coming in and discussing these topics today, Ian. It was very informative. Stay tuned. Ian and I are going to be giving you a dual hypnosis induction for confidence and inner strength. So be sure to listen to the second part of this podcast.